I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This is the second half of our interview with Al McCoy about his piece, Four Scenarios for the Coming Collapse of the American Empire. For the first half of the interview, go to IEET.org. You also talk in the essay about our declining sea power, our inability, which relates to the Paul Kennedy thesis that our sea power is one of the things that protects oil shipments and enables our control over oil-producing countries. As that begins to slip away from us, not only will the oil be going for economic reasons to China, but other countries will begin to have more influence in those regions.
Well, yeah. That takes us into the realm of military analysis, and there were two scenarios that we worked out in that area. Let's look at the first one that we call military misadventure or micromilitarism. What happens is as imperial powers decline, the military force that was so rational and effective in building and maintaining those empires at the peak can oftentimes turn irrational. And nations become psychologically attached, as we've seen with the statements of Sarah Palin and Mike Huckabee, to the idea of their global prominence. And as empires suffer retreat and defeat, they often seek to salve the psychological sting of decline by a bold military strike that is imagined will recover this waning power. Those strikes very often hemorrhage money or just produce outright debacles that in turn accelerates the decline. A classic case would be, let's say, Great Britain. They manage their imperial decline very carefully, but the stresses, the emotional psychological stresses, finally erupted in their abortive invasion of Suez in 1956. And this was a disaster that led to the convertibility of the pound sterling to the U.S. dollar and showed the world that basically British global power was dead. And there's a very real possibility that the United States could engage in a micromilitary operation similar to that. In fact, historians looking back, I think, are going to say that, you know, that what we call a war of choice in Iraq actually was a desperate act of micromilitarism to recover fading global power at a time when the United States' decline would already set in.
Well, in a way, the neoconservative ideology that our intervention there would lead to a domino effect of democracy throughout the region, that was an extension of American exceptionalism, the notion that we were the standard bearers for the Enlightenment that was suddenly going to set the region on fire with the fire of democracy.
Well, actually, there's a very interesting passage in Tony Blair's recent memoirs that came out a couple months ago. He describes how, he says it very expressly, he said, Dick Cheney, you know, saw invading Iraq as a first stop to overthrowing the Ba'athist regime there, and then invading Iran and totally remaking the Middle East. I mean, and what did they do instead? They sponsored insurgency inside Iraq and, you know, it cost us $1 trillion and 4,000 plus American lives. In other words, they got us. And, you know, Cheney thought he was going to play hardball rail politique. We got outplayed. We lost.
Right. Iran's going to control or post U.S.
Yeah.
Iraq.
Exactly. As Iran takes over, Iraq and forges an alliance with Syria and marginalizes Saudi Arabia and becomes a preeminent power in the Middle East, historians will look back and say, you know what? Cheney's plan, classic micromilitarism. Now you mentioned the contestation over sea power. One of the things that happened this summer, and it was really surprising, was that the United States has been quite comfortable, really since Nixon made his famous 1972 visit to China, with China's rise as an economic player and a global power. And we thought this would be quite benign, become quite complementary to U.S. economic presence in the global economy. And suddenly, they've called the question. When in last July, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton stated that the United States had a national interest in the fate of the South China Sea. China reacted very negatively. The official Global Times newspaper in Beijing stated, only in Chinese, by the way, in the Chinese edition, they stated, you know, that the contest for the South China Sea is going to tell us who the real ruler of the planet will be. And suddenly China started pushing at us. And then there were interesting signs. Two of our closest Cold War allies were Turkey and NATO and Australia and the Pacific. And this year, Turkey did the, they used U.S. fighters to do their first joint air exercises with China, and Australia did their first joint live firing exercises with Chinese naval forces in the Yellow Sea. So already, two of our closest allies, Australia and Turkey, are shifting to the rise of China. And this raises the possibility, as the Pentagon did in their review of Chinese military preparedness this summer, they issued a report to Congress, and it's very blunt, very frank, and states that China is building a missile system that can strike in any quadrant of the globe, including the United States. Furthermore, they're contesting U.S. dominance, what they call across the full spectrum of military operations. This means space and cyberspace. So what I did in the fourth scenario was to project forward to 2025 and say, okay, suppose these rising tensions with China were to erupt in some kind of military conflict. What would this conflict be? And here's how I think it might go. And by the way, all the weapons I'm going to talk about in the article in Time Dispatch, if you click the word, the name of each one, you go right to the Pentagon, right to the schematic drawings of this of these weapons. These are the weapons that are now on the drawing board. And let me note here, this is not pure fantasy, okay? That actually there is an event that happened in the last couple of weeks that nobody noticed in this country. But this event, if you will, is the mark of a new era in the history of human warfare. The X-37B. Have you ever heard of it?
No, I had not heard of it until I read it in your article.
Yeah, but you're like 99.99% of Americans. None of us have ever heard of this. But the X-37B space drone landed successfully at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California after a seven-month mission in space. And what this is the mark, this is the beginning, this marks the beginning of the full weaponization of space. And what this is a pilotless space shuttle that can be shot up into space, can operate for 7 or 8 months, and it doesn't just go in an orbit like a passive satellite in a geostationary orbit. You can drive it in space just like we can drive a Reaper or Predator drone over Afghanistan. And it's got a cargo bay that can carry missiles attacking enemy satellites. So here's my scenario. Let's say it's Thanksgiving Day, 2025. And just as cyber shoppers are pounding at the portals of, let's say, Best Buy or Walmart for the latest bargains in Chinese manufactured home appliances, out on Maui Island in Hawaii, at the base of the U.S. Space Surveillance Telescope, which is part of a global system that allows us to look at the entire sky above the Earth, suddenly the screen blips to black. And at that same moment, on the other side of the Pacific, over the Yellow Sea, a new U.S. aircraft, by that time we'll have a global flotilla of them, called the Vulcan, which is a giant flying wing, 400 feet wide, solar power, that's unmanned and can stay airborne for up to 5 years, flying at 70 to 80,000 feet above the Earth. Suddenly, one of these giant Vulture aircrafts has its rocket pods of Tripper Terminator missiles hacked in by Chinese cyber warriors, and it fires all its rockets downward into the depths of the Yellow Sea and is now completely disarmed. Meanwhile, at the operational headquarters of the U.S. Cyber Command at Lackland Air Base in Texas, computer analysts determined that this hacking has the distinctive digital fingerprints in the malware of Chinese cyber warriors, which we've analyzed and got on file. and the President of the United States orders a retaliatory attack. They order the flotilla of X-37Bs flying at 250 miles above the Earth to fire their triple Terminator missiles and knock out China's system of 35 orbital satellites. And as those computer codes are transmitted, nothing happens. The cargo bay doors are not opened. The missiles are not fired. And suddenly, as this Chinese malware virus spreads throughout the system of U.S. global satellites, the F-6 fractionated satellite system, which no longer are the satellites going to be, U.S. satellites going to be single components up in the sky. We're going to scatter the components, the pieces of the satellite, they're going to communicate by microwaves to give them greater resilience against attacks. Well, the malware spreads throughout our satellite system. Suddenly, U.S. GPS navigation and communication system worldwide are dead. Our carrier fleets in the Pacific steer aimless circles. U.S. fighter bombers worldwide are grounded. U.S. drones, Predator and Reaper, later generations, fly aimlessly, endlessly for the horizon until they crash for want of fuel. And suddenly, without the loss of a single human life, the United States has lost World War III, and the end of U.S. military power comes with a whimper.
Well, what I like best about that last part of your scenario, the military confrontation, is that hardly anybody gets whacked.
Yeah, I know. That's the way I see the wars of the future being fought.
Yeah. Well, that's
it. Will be in space, and it will probably be through rival cyber warfare. And mind you, if you look at the WikiLeaks on the issue of Chinese cyber warfare,
right,
it's clear that our intelligence community is very well aware of it. And, you know, why did we suddenly create, just last year,
Cyber
the U.S.
Command.
Cyber Command?
Exactly.
Because we are aware that this is now a critical arena.
Yeah.
And we now have a U.S. Space Command as well, by the way.
For the last 10 years or so, right? Mm-hmm. That Space Command document's been out for a while.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, if you look back again, as you have done, to the history of empires, so thank you for the scenarios are chilling and much greater detail in your article. But if you look back, as you and your fellow historians have done, at the previous empires, it's not all bad for the citizens of an imperial nation when they rewind their military overextension, right? There are some compensatory advantages to giving up.
In almost every case, what you see is two responses. First of all, there can be almost a generation of economic adjustment at home. That empires, although their costs and their advantages are born differentially. Some people get richer off it, and other people get poorer. But nonetheless, the society as a whole built into a situation of global advantage or global dominance when it makes an adjustment. Has a really wrenching adjustment. And even when it's very skillfully managed, like the British did, and they provide an optimum case of imperial adjustment, there was still a decade of rationing and very hard times in the United Kingdom during the late 40s and 1950s, a combination of decolonization and post-war reconstruction. You can look forward to a decade or a generation of really wrenching economic adjustment. Let's say the British case is one in which, you know, Britain always understood that it was a small nation ruling a vast empire. And even at their peak in 1897, 1900, the British were aware that their leadership over the world was very conditional. And once it began to fade away after World War One, the British government launched a sustained program of decolonization, and they managed it very carefully so that when it was all over, Britain had enfolded its former colonies as independent nations into the British Commonwealth, which gave them bilateral ties. They had preserved the role of the City of London as a major center of global capitalism, which had been a centerpiece of the British Empire anyway. And they also preserved their cultural leadership through the medium of English, which they created through their empire as a global language, and then the export of films and television and cultural productions. And, you know, that was a very carefully managed and extremely successful imperial transition. Okay, and they also turned over much of their imperial power very carefully to their close ally, to the United States. Some they gave us, some we grabbed. but it was more or less a negotiated transition, preserving British influence in the bargain. Well, in our case, because we're sort of in denial, we don't think of ourselves as a global power like all other global powers, although we have leaders like Obama and Biden that argue that our empire, our global power, or the American century, they use that term, American century, has to be carefully managed and it can be lost. On the political right, we have those like Sarah Palin, Mike Huckabee, who say that any discussion of this, any attempt to analyze it, manage it, is almost a sacrilege. So we're not really managing, we're not planning for this inevitable transition. After all, it's our intelligence community has told us that in 15 years, we are going to lose power. Our power will decline. Well, we're not planning for it.
Well, I can't argue with the fact that we have right-wing denialism about all of this, but comparison with the Commonwealth and with the relative success of the Brits in managing a post-colonial succession brings to mind the fact that Gordon Brown's out this week with a book calling for a new global set of financial regulatory institutions, and that in some sense the network of transnational institutions, the United Nations and the World Trade Organization and so forth, is the American Commonwealth. I mean, it's a set of institutions that we've created at an international level, which in an ideal, to me at any rate, an ideal scenario, would take up increasingly the kind of regulatory roles that the U.S. has been trying to do as a sole hegemon. You don't think that this is a possibility, that we're evolving past a nation-state level of global governance to a transnational level?
Yes, but it's that transition, the way we're managing it is going to mean that's a possible scenario, and one that we actually canvass in the article, that the United States would descend to a kind of a primus inter pares, or maybe even a secondary power within a kind of a global oligopoly of nations, the fading powers or the former powers like Germany, Britain, France, U.S., and rising powers, China, Brazil, India, would form a global oligopoly, not unlike that which ruled the world in 1900 in the Age of Empire. It wasn't just the British. There were seven or eight nations who were major international players at that time. So we could return to a situation like that, but that system would mean that there would be inevitably a loss of certain kinds of privileges that the Americans enjoyed, or that we enjoyed as global hegemon. And one of them would be preferential access to oil at a below market rate. That's going to end, and we're not planning for that transition. So yes, U.S. corporations, U.S. corporate elite, certain aspects of the U.S. government might do very well, but the structural unemployment and the reduced standard of living for most Americans would also be a consequence of that transition unless we plan for it and prepare for it and make the necessary adjustments.
Now, that's what I spun out, what you've described is more of a top-down form of global reorganization of multipolar global power. On the left, as you mentioned, from Lenin and up to the present anti-globalization activists, there's another idea, more utopian idea, that there could be a counter-hegemonic globalist democratic movement of some sort that would put forward alternative models of world power. Do you see any of the ligaments of that kind of a global movement in the various things that have been happening around the world?
There was the anti-globalization movement, which, erupted in the late 90s, most famously at Seattle, and turned up at every meeting of the World Trade Organization ever since, but it sort of faded. And its program was a sum of opposition. Opposition to WTO, opposition to genetically modified foods, opposition to the placing of patents on certain indigenous plants, that sort of thing. It's faded. What we are seeing in the United States in terms of some kind of populist movement has been the Tea Party. And so far I haven't seen a really interesting or convincing analysis of what the Tea Party is all about. And again, in a comparative imperial perspective, there's actually a pretty good analogy. In the mid-1950s, this movement called the Pujadist movement erupted in France. And it was apparently driven by two forces. One, middle-class people facing economic pressures that were reducing their standard of living. Well, the Tea Party is that. They're not, in fact, poor. They're middle to upper middle class. And second, that the crisis of empire was percolating through France. They just lost Indochina. They just lost their Vietnam War. They were fighting and losing in Algeria. And the result of this was to have this populist movement that was enormously emotional, very noisy, and captured 17% of the electorate and put, among others, Jean-Marie Le Pen, the racist head of the French National Party, into Parliament as a young politician and launched his career as a kind of right-wing force in France, which he's remained for the last 50 years. The Tea Party movement is very much like that, you know, driven by sort of the crisis of American power and the economic pressures that come from our ongoing decline, and angry over various shifts in the economy which are pressing on middle-class lifestyles, and yet, like the Pujadist movement, not really coming up with a rational response to these pressures, these changes. Very emotional, very angry, lashing out, a movement of negatives marked by opposition to people and to change rather than embracing and coming up with creative responses. But I think that that ferment that we saw, the anger and the passion that we saw in the Tea Party movement, is a manifestation of the process of decline. It's yet to be seen whether we can, in fact, if you will, have a discussion across partisan divide and with the same passion kind of have a Sputnik moment in which we come up with a shared national agenda for dealing with these ongoing global pressures. I don't know if you saw the interview earlier in the month with Zygmunt Brzezinski in Der Spiegel. Mm-hmm. Very interesting one. Zygmunt Brzezinski, of course, was the former national security advisor under President Carter and a very intelligent architect of American power. It was he that that gave us the Afghan operation, launched the Mujahideen to evict the Soviet Union. He was the architect of that famous meeting between Carter, Menachem Begin, and Sadat. I mean, he was a very skillful diplomat and a real student of U.S. global power. He says that, look, you know, there's no question the global system is impinging upon the United States at the level of energy and many others. And he calls the current leaders of the populist movement that are responding to these changes, he calls them stunningly ignorant. He's really blunt about that. And I'd have to agree with Brzezinski.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, the other thing, other than the rise of the Tea Party in the United States that's been so depressing to me is that I've for decades been a supporter of the European project, an enthusiast about European integration as a model for a multi-ethnic, democratic, post-nation-state form of governance. And now that seems to be falling apart as well. I mean, does that play into your scenario at all?
Yeah, the European experiment doesn't work. That removes one major player in the global stage, economically and politically. If the European experiment can be made to work, that will then create a very potent competitor. Right now, the EU is the world's number one exporter. And with German industry and its formidable engineering and innovation and very strong education system, they're in a position to be a real contender in the global stage. And of course, as they advantage themselves, we get disadvantaged. So yes, the European experiment will play into that, but I think that, the particulars aside, is the China going to have a middle class? Will their minority problems erupt with the free ride they're taking on the environment, mismanaging their commons, which they are, will that slow China? Yeah, these are important factors. What about climate change? Well, how will that impact on everybody? Yes, that's a fact. But I think, you just track the trajectories forward and you can see the signs of decline, just as the U.S. National Intelligence Council has done. There's no question. The only question is really, is this going to be a soft landing one that we plan, prepare for, and negotiate self-consciously? Or is this going to be a sudden shock to our system that we find ourselves declining rapidly without plan or preparation? No, that's really the only question that remains at this point.
Al, is there another meeting of the Empires in Transition group?
Sadly, no. I suppose you could say chalk it up to American decline, but we got very limited funding, and we I think we used it well, produced one volume, and now we're, unless George Soros is going to call us up and say bring it work,
or Fidel. Since he's he's enthusiastic about your piece.
Well, yes, but I don't think he's in a position to send me any money, and I'm not sure we'd want to take it anyway. Things being what they are in the United States and Cuba,
right?
But we're devoting our energy to right now is taking the papers from our last conference and turning them into a volume, which will hopefully be published next year under the title of Endless Empire.
Ah, well, we're looking forward to that. So the current work can be found at the Wisconsin site if you Google for U.S. Empire Project, Rise and Decline of American Global Power. And we've been talking about Al McCoy's article, Four Scenarios for the Coming Collapse of the American Empire. Al's at University of Wisconsin in Madison and the author of several books, many books on imperialism and before that on drugs. So we very much appreciate this conversation and look to have you back once that volume's out.
All right. Thank you very much.
This has been the second half of our interview with Al McCoy about his Four Scenarios for the Coming Collapse of the American Empire piece. For the first half of the interview, go to IEET.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.